Hello, everybody, and welcome to Paddock Project. We are so thrilled for our guest today. We are here with none other than Matt Wyman, the author of the book titled Inside Mercedes F1, which is releasing in the U.S. November 12th, which by the time you're hearing this, I think that's tomorrow. So the book details the 2023 and 2024 seasons in the post-dominance era of Mercedes as the team sort of grapples with no longer being at the front of the grid. Toto Wolff himself said about this book that it's based on unprecedented access to the team. So we have so much to dive into. But first, Matt, welcome. We're so excited to chat with you today.
Thank you very much for having me. Hi.
Yes. So this may or may not be an easy question to start with, but we're going to start with something uplifting. What was the highlight of writing this book for you?
The highlight was quite possibly the project itself, the opportunity to join a team such as Mercedes F1 and to be embedded with the team, to become part of the team for 18 months was kind of an offer that was too good to be true. I am a motorsports fan. I watch Formula One. So to have this invitation was something that I couldn't refuse. At the same time, it was a huge task. The challenge of painting a portrait of the team in such a fast-moving environment was there was no blueprint for it. You know, it was just something that I had to kind of figure out, how am I going to do this and how am I going to work through it. So that in a way was a highlight. Now I look back at it and I look at that 18 months and just, you know, I look through photographs and I look through the book and I just think it was just insane, really, that jumping on that roller coaster.
That is so cool. And I think you said it exactly right. I mean, to get under the hood of Mercedes is no small feat. When I was at Brackley this summer, it sort of felt like entering Langley with the aura of secrecy, which is where the CIA is based here. But, you know, for example, you just get a level of insight into Toto's decision making and feelings about Lewis's departure, Lewis's own thoughts on his career that we haven't really heard anywhere else. So how did you go about gaining the trust of the team to get that level of access?
So, yeah, it's a good question. I think the key really was time. That I had 18 months with the team, and that meant I was on the travel itinerary with them. I traveled with them. I stayed in the same hotels. I shared meals with them, hung out with them outside the track. We went go-karting, you know, did everything that any other team member would do. I was issued with team kit very early on, which was a kind of a conscious decision that I think if the team felt that there was a journalist wandering around, it would be very different. I'm not a journalist. I'm a writer, and I think there is quite a difference. Nevertheless, anyone in the team would be naturally quite guarded, I think, in the company of a journalist, thinking, well, are they going to catch me out? And I wasn't there to catch anyone out. I was simply there to paint a portrait, whether that warts and all, really. So what I saw was what goes into the book. So really, it was just a question of gaining their trust through time and demonstrating that I'm completely impartial, and I am literally just painting what I see, talking to people, relaying what I see, and telling the story, essentially, of a team at a moment in time. And it kind of it worked out, I think, in terms of, as I mean, the first race that I went to was just a sensory overload, as I'm sure you know. You go into the paddock and there's just so much going on. But over time, as you know, went from one race to another, and I got to know the team. I think initially it's quite overwhelming because you just don't know anyone, and there's, you know, upwards of 100, 200 people in the team in the paddock. And as I got to know people and I got to know names and I became familiar with them, I could sit down and have a conversation with them over breakfast just about nothing. You know, just usual talking absolute rubbish. But then something would come up within that conversation that I would think that's useful for the book, and we might, you know, I might go back and talk to them about it later on, or so that having that sort of luxury of time, if you like, was key to gaining trust. And I mean, I learned pretty quickly that everyone in the team has a nickname, and I remember saying to someone, have I got a nickname? And everyone kind of looked at their desks. I thought, yeah, I've got a nickname. I'm not sure what it is.
You still don't know?
No, but I figured that probably wasn't a bad thing. If I've got a nickname, then I'm clearly doing all the right things. So I just set out to just fit in as quietly as possible, and just to gain everyone's trust slowly, steadily. And that's what I did, really. And as a result, I got to see things that initially, I think people might have been quite guarded about, but towards once I was settled in, they're absolutely fine. You know, debriefs, all that kind of stuff.
Well, we commend both sides for that, because I think on your side, it takes a certain level of humility to approach it that way. And for them, it just takes a certain level of trust to be open and allow that to even happen in the first place. So,
yeah. And I think to give you some context initially, that this is a book that has been, it's a project that was devised by my publisher Penguin and Mercedes, and they've been talking for quite some time about, we've got to do a book, you know, the 8 times World Constructor Champions, you know, the greatest team of the modern age, we'd love to do a book. And it was just a question of timing, I think, and I don't know how long they've been talking, but I think it was quite a few seasons. And then 2022 didn't go that well, as we all know, for Mercedes. And I think there was this sense of, from the team, that we've had a bad year, 2023 is going to be the comeback year. This is the year that we can bring in an author and to document the comeback. And that's certainly, when I first went into Mercedes, that was how that's how they saw the project. And wow. So very, very, very quickly, from initially getting a call saying, how do you fancy being embedded with the Mercedes F1 team, to actually finding myself at the first Grand Prix of the season in the pit garage, it didn't go well. This is 2023. The first race of the season, Red Bull ran away with it. And Mercedes, I think, were just over half a second off the pace in qualifying.
Wow.
0.6 of a second. And it was the end of the world. And I'd said, you know, if you try to sort of visualize or conceptualize half a second, it's a blink of an eye. And they're going, yeah, but in this sport, half a second is probably 6 months in the wind tunnel. So to catch up on that half a second was going to take half the season. So, and I vividly remember, it was kind of almost being thrown into the deep end. I was in my first race weekend and I was taken into the pit garage and they said, just stand here and don't move. And I was my position was right behind where Toto stands, with my back to kind of like a tool cabinet. So standing right there, and you've got Mick Schumacher, Toto, all of the head of that, the bridge of that engineering center. And they said, just don't move. And when you go into a pit garage, the space is at a premium. There are mechanics walking around. There's a lot of mechanics. The cars fill the space. You can't really wander around without getting hit in the face by a tire trolley or whatever. And you don't want to get in the way. So I took them at their word and I thought, I'm not moving. I'm just going to stand here with my notebook and I'm going to take notes and, you know, watch it all. And so this qualifying unfolded and it didn't go to plan. And right at the end of the qualifying session, the flag fell, everyone disappeared. So the mechanics went off to Parc Fermé to retrieve the cars, the engineers went off to the debrief, every single person in that garage effectively vanished apart from Toto. And Toto was just on his high stool staring at the data on the screen. And I was thinking, and I thought, well, no one's told me I can leave yet. And, you know, I'm still thinking, don't move. So, and then I'm just thinking,
stuck here, yeah.
Does he know I'm here? Does he eat? And I don't think he did. And I was just slightly awful, sort of awkward social kind of, do I go, you know, tap him on the shoulder and go, hi, I'm the writer. And I thought, no, just stay here, just stay quiet. And actually, in the end, I left because he just didn't move. But it was a really revealing moment of a team boss faced with the reality of his upcoming season and all the hopes and the Herculean effort that had gone into building that car, and it was that far off the pace. So I initially thought, actually, this is all over. They're not going to want me doing this project at a time when this comeback isn't happening. You know, and they've effectively written off the season at the start of the 2023. So I expected a handshake and, you know, thanks very much and, you know, nice knowing you. But actually, they to their credit, they doubled down. And wow. I think they recognised that a team in adversity is a lot more revealing. A portrait of a team in adversity is a lot more revealing than a team that's just winning every race and hoovering up the next championship effortlessly.
And kind of more of an interesting book too.
Of course. For me, it was much more interesting. So I was really grateful to them for that, to show me that level of trust that, you know, we're on the back foot, but we're going to honor our commitment to this project. And so in a way, I was witness to a really revealing moment in the team's history, which was they'd had an off year and then found themselves in this kind of horror of a second off year. And it was, is this going to break the team? Is it going to break Toto? Or is it going, what's going to happen? Right. And so it was a fascinating insight into how does a high performance team, having taken several punches, you know, if you go back to the end of the 2021 season,
the biggest punch of them all.
Yeah, exactly. And you kind of, everyone expected Mercedes to come back in 2022 in terms of sort of a classic story, and it didn't happen. And then here we are in 23. So they're kind of on the ropes. And so it was really, really interesting to watch Toto lead the way, really, and kind of galvanize the team to step up to this really challenging moment. And I think what's often lost about last season, which, you know, Red Bull ran away with it, but Mercedes started in poor shape, and yet they wrestled a challenging car to second in the constructors. And that was no mean feat. And I think it was a bit lost in the whole kind of Red Bull, you know, sweeping it up. But that was really interesting to watch. It wasn't where they wanted to be second. You know, they didn't want to be second. They wanted to be first. But when it came down to the chase, they were just as committed to that than anything else.
And including you anyway. So speaking of Toto, he's one of the most famous and recognizable team principals to F1 fans. People are super interested in him and his leadership style. And what you were talking about the Bahrain Grand Prix in 2023, your book opens with such a compelling description of that. And you wrote that Toto said in an engineering meeting, quote, "We need to feel a certain degree of embarrassment here," and just a reflection of really how hard he was taking it. And what stood out to you the most about Toto's leadership style? You already talked about how seeing him just sitting in the garage alone, staring at the data. How did he kind of move forward from that to lead the team?
So that line that you refer to was in the post-testing debrief. So, and that was my first exposure to the Mercedes F1 team. So it was on a Sunday. I went over to Brackley, and the engineers had just flown back from testing in Bahrain. They literally got off the plane, got onto driven to the factory, straight into this huge meeting in this enormous meeting room with like a 20-meter long table and screens that come out of the table, and it was like attending a funeral wake. The team, they were looking at all the data, and it didn't match their expectations in terms of what they were seeing in the simulations. And so, but to come into that, this is my first exposure in it, and it was like, who's died? And it was almost like, well, the hopes and dreams of the season have just gone. But here, this was Toto at the end of the session when they went through all the data and it was apparent what was going on. They still had a week to go before the first Grand Prix, and a week is a long, long time in Formula One. So they still had a week to get to grips with the issues, to try and resolve them, the engineering issues, the mechanical issues, the aerodynamic issues, to iron out the creases in this car. So there was still kind of hope, if you like. And Toto's role at the end of this meeting, and really at the end of every briefing, is to pull together the kind of the central themes of that everyone has been discussing, and then kind of filter that through the prism of team leadership to say, this is what we've got to do, this is what we're aiming for, and yeah, I believe, you know, that you can do it. In this particular occasion, when he said, you know, we need to feel a degree of embarrassment, I think that was the start of a bit of a journey that I think is reflected in the book, whereby at the start of the 2023 season, and it's something that several team members comment on later on, at the start of the 2023 season, Mercedes F1 had this kind of legacy of, we're 8-time World Constructors Champions. We're this unbeatable team that's had an off year. And so to suddenly find themselves in this fairly shocking state, they almost had, when he says, you know, we need to feel a degree of embarrassment, in a way it's because they're looking backwards, going, well, we're the 8-time, you know, we're unbeatable. We need to be embarrassed about this. If you then cut forward to the end of the book, which, because the book goes into the 2024 season, there has almost been a kind of a, not a rebirth, but just a kind of a reset, where the team are forward thinking and they're looking forward, and they've almost kind of broken free from that legacy, which no one's going to take away from them. But it's almost like if they're going to win another constructors, they're going to do it on the merit of that season rather than, well, we're Mercedes. And that expectation, which is often a bit of a weight around their shoulders. I think that you know, yeah. Mercedes come fourth in a race, and it's like, well, you know, that's terrible. What's happened? And it's just because it's Mercedes. Anyone else would be, yes, that's a result. And so they have to kind of use that in a kind of fairly positive way. But yeah, that line that is in the book at the start is really the beginning of a journey for the team, for Toto as well. And he talks about that when I sat down with him for the big interview. But yeah, his leadership style, he's very, by his own admission, you know, he's not an aerodynamicist. He's not tire specialist, but he attends every meeting, briefing, race debrief, spends time with all the engineers, and so has a pretty good understanding of it, and is able to just take the key messages and just kind of galvanize the team, if you like. So his leadership style is not in any way a sort of micromanager. It's just being there, listening, and just pulling through the key themes that everyone needs to walk away with.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything particularly unique about a day in the life of Toto? Like, what does a day in the life look like for him? As much as you can generalize that, but we're all very curious.
Yeah, I mean, he's incredibly busy. Very, very busy. Yeah. Everything is very diarized. He's got a full schedule each and every day. Wow. As I say, he attends every driver brief. This is at the racetrack on a race weekend. Every briefing, every debrief, and there are a lot. The engineers are constantly in meetings. And he's always there. And if he's not there, he's in his office. He's on the phone, talking to partner guests, doing media. There's very little downtime. That being said, the paddock is quite a small place, so he's constantly moving from one place to the next, and has always got time for every team member. You know, there's always a smile and a hi and hello and a quick chat. It's not a kind of a, you know, eyes down and I'm very busy, I'm the team boss. And it's interesting, it's quite revealing, because I think we all see with any character in Formula One, you know, you see them on the TV in a particular setting talking about a particular thing. So it's quite revealing to see them kind of off duty, if you like, off guard. And there's a human being like anyone else, you know, he's very funny. Things that you don't often see, I suppose, on the TV.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you've been saying, you've been fully embedded with the team across both the past two seasons. You attended over a dozen races across five continents. Are there any particular moments, good or bad, that stood out to you through that travel?
Oh yeah, I mean, absolutely loads. So the setting of the book is, it's 18 months for a reason. So it was the we're looking at a year in the life of a race team, but we also wanted to document the development of next year's car, because alongside the racing that's been going on that we've all been watching for 2023, back at the factory is the development of the 2023 car. Back at the factory is the development of the next year's car. So I'm getting ahead of behind myself. And we don't often see much of that. And effectively, the team are on a war footing back at the factory and progressively through the year in terms of bringing this prototype vehicle, two of them together. So in order to tell that story, we cover the 2023 season, and then we also sort of follow parallel to that the development of the 24 car, and then finally we see the 24 car in action for the first half of the season. So I went to, I don't know, 15, 16 different races, and in terms of sort of memorable points or high points, I mean, there are numerous ones, but the one that probably left me shaking in my boots was Spa, Belgium. And I was, each race I shadowed a particular individual in the race team, whether it was a driver, whether it was an engineer or a mechanic, anyone, and just to kind of get to grips with what they're doing, because the book isn't just about Lewis, Toto and George. It's about, there are 2,000 people in the team. So it's about all the people that we don't necessarily hear about. And at Spa, I was shadowing the rear jack man called Carl Fanson, who you often see in pit stops. He's the big guy, stands at the back, slots the trolley into the back of the car and hoists it up. He also has another job as a race team
the
logistics.
DHL logistics, yeah. He does everything. It's crazy.
Literally, he's responsible for moving the entire circus from working out how all the logistics are going to work, how everything is going to be in Canada one race, Azerbaijan the next. So he's got two jobs. So during a race, puts his overalls on, and he's part of the pit stop crew. So I was talking to him at the back of the pit garage about being the rear jack man, and I was saying, so you know, I'd watched him quite a few times doing it, and it's quite balletic. So they do pit stop practice some 60 times in a weekend, and everything is analyzed really closely. There's videos above, and they can watch all the movement and how it's all working. And I had said to Carl, you know, you're quite balletic in the way that you kind of twist your foot and you pull it down, and he just laughed, and he went, well, you know, it's a bit of a knack. He's quite a humble guy. And I went, oh, okay. And he said, hey, come and watch me do it in a minute. And so I think the next time there was a pit stop practice, we came out, it's pouring a rain. And whenever there's a pit stop practice, there's media watching, there are fans, it's all roped off. And they do a few, they come in and whatever it is that they're looking at in particular. And I was standing under the pit garage watching. And he finished this George Russell's car, finished doing the pit stop. And he looked at me, and he had had his fire kit on, had his helmet. And he just shoved the handle of the jack towards me. And I kind of looked over my shoulder thinking, well, there's probably someone over there. Looked back, and he was nodding at me and beckoning at me. And I thought, oh, no, I can't. So I couldn't say no, because suddenly there's all the press that are watching. And so I stepped out into the rain.
And you're in the team kit, so you look like you're
I look like I should know what I'm doing. And so he gave me this thing, and he just said, just put your weight onto it. Put your weight over the top of it, and don't. You know, put too much effort into it. And I was so shocked at what he'd asked me to do in front of all these people. I thought, I can't mess this up. So I kind of really took him at his word, and I lifted my whole body over the top of it, and I pushed down. You can feel it going. I thought, thank God for that, it's going. And it went up, and I felt the stopper hit the ground, as in job done. I thought, and I did wave of relief. And the car was up in the air, and it started wobbling from left to right. And I thought, oh my God, there's like 5 million quid's worth of car up on this thing,
and everyone's watching. Stabilizers.
Everyone's exactly all the stabilizers watching me, and I just put it down as quick as I could, as gently as I could, like a baby. That's and Carl so took funny. The handle off me when he said, "I told you it was a knack," and I was never quite sure what he meant by that. That was a knack that I didn't have, but it left me. I had to go out to the front of the garage after that, and I was just shaking. I was so
that's incredible.
Shocked that he'd asked me. I mean, it was such a privilege, but equally to feel that car shake, quivering in the air, thinking it could just fall off the jack. At any moment. I mean, I don't know whether it would or not, but it wasn't something that I was prepared
wow.
for.
Wow.
So yeah, that was incredible. That was one of my memorable
pressure.
Moments. It was.
Spark something uncommon this holiday with just the right gift from Uncommon Goods. With the holiday season upcoming, Uncommon Goods makes it less stressful with incredible hand-picked gifts for everyone on your list. Their gifts really do spark joy. We've given them to a lot of our friends. Tiggy gave me one where you can kind of like color in a photo. So we did one of the three of us in Vegas at the F1 race. So basically all of these gifts kind of have that, it's exactly what I wanted feeling. Somehow they know exactly what you can get for every single person on your list, from holiday gifts and hostess gifts, gifts for kids, gifts for sports fans and book lovers. It's literally everything that you need in one place, and it's all very unique. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They donated more than $3 million to date. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/paddockproject. That's uncommongoods.com/paddockproject for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. The end of the season, the end of the F1 season is upon us. And as we're busy going to races and wrapping up everything, we are trying to do everything we can to feel our best. And one thing that we have been using to help us are our Happy Mammoth products. We've been using them for a while, especially Estro Control. It really helps us support our hormones and alleviate those pesky PMS symptoms, including bloating. It also assists in maintaining cognitive health and promoting liver function and digestive health, which is really good as we're really busy and wrapping up and heading into holiday party season. Happy Mammoth, who also has the amazing Hormone Harmony supplement, it's a brand that's dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women, and they make no compromises when it comes to quality. For a limited time, get 15% off your order at happymammoth.com with code F1RTheGirls at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code F1RTheGirls for 15% off today. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning F1 championships is sometimes also what you need to keep your beloved car running day in and day out. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're looking for speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has got you covered. They have over 122 million parts for your car. You'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And they have eBay Guaranteed Fit, which means your part is guaranteed to fit your car every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're about burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. So keep your car alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Speaking of some other moments on the team, you were with the team when the shock announcement came in that Lewis was moving to Ferrari for the 2025 season. That happened in February. What was the atmosphere like at the team when that happened? And you talked to Toto about this in detail as well, which you talk about in the book.
Well, there was certainly a shock. It was news that was out of the blue. But I think also there was a sort of a practicality about it, which was that the next season is about to start. And so we need to process this. And it's not like he'd left. Quite often when drivers leave, you know, they've gone.
Right.
And that's it. This is like, well, it's a bit unknown territory. By Lewis's own admission, it was slightly weird to be kind of leaving and then you've got a whole year ahead of you.
Before the season even starts.
Yeah, exactly. But I think there was an element of just, you know, lots of adults in the room really with that in mind, is that actually we've got to make this work. You know, there's no point getting emotional about this. And Lewis was very clear, I'm still committed to this team. This is just something that I'm doing. So initially there was a shock. And then the first time pretty much everyone actually saw Lewis was at the shakedown, which is the first time the car is rolled out to the media. And it's also a chance for the teams to see if it's basically pointing in the right direction. So you get to do sort of two laps around around the track at Silverstone. This is Valentine's Day, I think, 14th of February. So not long, you know, 10 days, week or 2 weeks after the announcement. And it was very weird to see him there initially for about 30 seconds. And then Lewis is poking about the front of the car, looking at the suspension, and nothing had really changed. And so I sat down with Toto soon afterwards, actually. And he said, yeah, you know, of course it was a shock. But he was very keen to stress that he's been friends with Lewis for a long, long time. They've achieved so much together. He wasn't going to squander a friendship over, in his words, a business decision. And he respected the business decision. Mm. And really his view, I think, as time passed, was actually, this is an opportunity. This is the hand that I've been dealt, if you like. This is an opportunity now to do something different. So I think all sides handled it very well. I know it was deeply awkward initially, and sitting down talking to Lewis about it, you know, he told me that it's well documented that he went to see Toto to break the news face to face, because in his words, it was the right thing to do. You know, he said the easiest thing to do is like send an email, but it's not, you know, it's not the right thing to do. And, you know, as difficult and as awkward as it is, face to face is the right thing. So he said he did that, but he said the hardest thing after that was he had scheduled arranged a paintballing session with his team, which is a traditional thing that they do before the start of the season. So they all go off and, you know, have this session, and it had been arranged. And so his next task was to jump in the car and to travel to the paintballing place, wherever it was. Oh. And he said he arrived and he saw them all larking around outside the entrance. And he said he couldn't get out of the car for 20 minutes because he just didn't know what to say to them. And in the end, you know, and talking to him, I really felt for him. It's a huge thing to, because he said it's like a marriage. It's going, well, I'm leaving you, but not yet. I'm still going to be around for a year. It's really difficult. And he handled it, you know, and I think everyone handled it as well as they might, which was, okay, this is your decision. I did say, were you targeted extra, you know, were you like the main target during the paintball session? And yeah. A lot of red, I imagine.
He told them before the paintballing session. That's a dangerous thing to do.
Maybe should have waited until afterwards. I think it was actually a kind of a lesson in listening to him. It's kind of a lesson in doing the right thing, really. You know, I imagine it was excruciatingly difficult but it was the right thing to do. And then you pull that plaster off and pull that Band-Aid off and you get on, you know. And from that moment on, we just got on, really. And it was kind of by the time we got to the start of the season, which wasn't long, 2 weeks later, it was okay. This is the last season. Let's try and make it, you know, make it work. And that was it, really. There wasn't really drama. It was more just a sort of like the social kind of awkwardness of grasping this nettle.
Yeah. So you mentioned you were a motorsports fan before this. Mm. Were you a Mercedes fan? And if so, did this make you even more of a Mercedes fan?
Yeah. So this process? I'm not terribly sporty, but I have always been a lifelong motor racing fan because my uncle was a racing driver. And so when I was much younger, I used to go and watch him race. My abiding memory of being a 10-year-old is having my birthday party at Silverstone. And he was racing Formula 3, the same time as Nigel Mansell. So they were racing in the same seasons. And I remember being there with my friends and larking around in the pit lane, tripping over fuel hoses. And I mean, things that you just wouldn't do nowadays, really sort of dangerous stuff. And I just remember being up in the grandstand, super proud of my friends, and he took off, start of the race, and he didn't come around for the second lap. There was just a column of smoke at the far side of the circuit. And I asked him about it the other day. I said, I don't want you to just do you a disservice, but you did crash, didn't you? You didn't break down. And he sent me a picture back of like about four cars in the air, twisting around upside down. So there was definitely a crash of some sort. But no. That was my kind of early exposure to motorsport. And so I never really left me. So I've always been a Formula One fan. I kind of followed Lewis a bit from the start of his career and then from McLaren to Mercedes. So was I a Mercedes fan? Yes. I mean, that was probably the focus of my attention. Not a kind of hardcore, you know, everything Mercedes, but I certainly would watch it through the prism of Lewis and Mercedes. And so it was a very strange transition to go from watching it on the sofa with my son, who is also he's a big Mercedes fan, to finding myself in the garage. And I've got Sky Sports camera
for a year and a half.
I know too. my son texted me going, I can see you in the garage.
And he's cool. Watching that's it on like the sofa. The proudest son moment.
it was strange. And then the transition back to that after this whole project is finished, it's taken me about four or five races to kind of mentally put my notebook down and think I don't need to make a notebook.
Yeah.
So go back to being a fan.
That's a great point. This has been so fascinating. We're so excited for everyone to get to read the book. So just to wrap up, can you read us a short favorite excerpt from the book? Anywhere in the book that you want people to hear?
There's a little, I'll just quickly give you a bit of a backstory that I think it was in Spain. I was in the pit garage, and at the back of the garage, there are kind of viewing booths. So there's like kind of two rows for VIP guests to sit in, and they've got screens in front of them. And in front of that are tour cabinets. And then on each side is a little bucket seat for the driver. And that's where they sit when they're not in the car and such like. And I was in the pit garage watching the mechanics. I think I was shadowing one of the mechanics, and they were stripping the car down. Drivers weren't anywhere to be seen. And I was in there for about 2 hours just chatting and watching. And I've been on my feet for quite a long time, and I was writing on my notebook. I thought, I really want to sit down. But I thought, the only available seat is Lewis's seat. And I don't feel quite right about doing that. So I didn't. I thought, I just don't do it. Just stay on your feet. And at that race, Lewis was in the car. I think it was a practice session. And the place was rammed. Every seat was taken in terms of the viewing gallery. To the extent that one of the guests had come in, all the seats were filled. So he had sat down in Lewis's seat. And Lewis is in the car, and all the mechanics are attending to him. And I've got my headset on, so I can hear everything. All the mechanics got their headphones in. And I hear Lewis going, who's in my seat? And literally everyone in the garage, this guy, poor guy, can't hear anything. Everyone in the garage looks around at this guy. And Bono goes, pass. And because Lewis goes, well, I can see him in my mirror. And that was the end of it. And I just thought, thank God I didn't take his seat. That's clearly,
it wasn't you.
Never sit in Papa Bear's seat. That's where he sits. And it kind of stayed with me a bit. And then later on in the season, I was scheduled to talk to Lewis. And I'd arranged to meet him in the motorhome at a table. And Lewis has got his, quite often he has his own table in the, if they're due into the motorhome, the hospitality will put out a little name card. It's just his number. It just says 44. That's where Lewis is sitting.
So wow.
I went down to, it's kind of reserved, you know, it's like a reserved thing. I went down to find him and he wasn't there. And I'd seen him there about 5 minutes earlier, sitting on one side, on like the comfy side. And then there's a sort of just normal chairs on the other. I thought, I'll take the other chair because that seems like the right thing to do. The only thing that confused me was his water bottle was sitting, was sort of positioned next to the kind of like the worst chair, if you like, the one that I'd chosen. I thought, well, never mind. So I was just looking at my notes. So this is an extract, it's a very short extract. Mindful of the episode at the Spanish Grand Prix the previous season, in which a guest had inadvertently made himself comfortable in Hamilton's personal station behind the car in the pit garage, I hesitate about which side of the table I should occupy. Given that he had favoured the bench side for lunch, I pull out the chair opposite. A moment later, just as I'm consulting my notebook at the table, I feel a hand grasp my shoulder. "Hey man, you're in my seat." With a start, I look up and around. The 7-time world champion is standing over me. For a split second, I'm mortified. Then I register a winning grin before he drops onto the bench opposite. Lewis Hamilton has arrived and he's in high spirits. "I'm just messing with you," he says on settling in to talk. And that to me was another moment where I thought, oh no, the chair thing's gone all wrong. But he's got a good sense of humour. He'd heard about it. Someone had told him about it, that I noted this chair thing.
That excerpt just says so many things in so few words about Lewis and about that's amazing. Well, Matt, thank you so much. This was such a highlight for us to chat with you. And we're so excited for everyone to read the book out tomorrow in the US. And we'll chat with you soon. Thank you
very much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.